Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is David Gessner, author of Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's American Dream, published by Simon & Schuster. When I was a kid, we learned a lot about Theodore Roosevelt, or TR, and we learned to recite his Man in the Arena speech. And I've read most of his quotes and thought him to be a great man. And I believe that David feels the same way, but maybe at times with some ambivalence. Because in addition to creating hundreds of millions of acres of national forest and parklands, he also hunted down buffalo, had some nasty things to say about indigenous peoples, and felt a certain disdain for those who were good-hearted but not tough enough. So yeah, the book is about TR, but it's also the story of David, and peripherally, almost as a foil, his nephew Noah. And it's also a story of our land and what has become of it and what is becoming of it, the current administration and in part past ones, and what easing of regulations and downsizing our natural lands have done to our country and to David's sensibilities. So in all, it's a reminder, a wake-up call that we're on the verge of something terrible, and the clock is running, has almost run out, and what we can still do to stop it in its tracks, to mix metaphors, and try to save our planet and our other non-human neighbors. So welcome, David, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So I guess because, you know, like I said, I think a lot of people today don't really know that much at all about Teddy Roosevelt. So maybe the best way to start is the title itself.
Yeah, Leave It As It is what Roosevelt said standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon. He was in the middle of a 16,000 mile going every which way, zigzagging around the United States. What was the first real campaign tour by a sitting president? It was where they coined the phrase whistle stop tour. And he would be rushing from place to place, giving three speeches a day. He was this whirlwind of energy. I only later found out as I was researching that he fueled himself with this big, like, gallon cup of coffee that he started drinking in the morning and drank all day and then drank before he went to sleep and energetically went to sleep and woke up again the next day. And actually, his phrase, good to the last drop, was the one that Maxwell House used as their slogan for forever. So he comes rushing into the Grand Canyon to give yet another speech. But in the morning, he goes up and horseback trip up to the edge, and he sees that great purple bruised, you know, the sight so many of us have seen, which no matter how hyped it is before, can't help but blow you away, basically. And so he sees that. He also identifies a lot of birds, which impresses his companions. And I like to think that he revised his set speech that morning. And the speech he delivers, I say in the book, is like the equivalent of the Gettysburg Address for environmentalists. And he basically says, nothing should be built here, not a hotel, not a house. We should leave it for our children's children, which is a kind of, you know, Native Americans have been thinking that way forever. But for the United States, this was a new concept, kind of connecting oneself by blood to the future. You know, our children's children should be able to come here and see the same sight. So it's a stirring speech, and I just think that Leave It As It is a great motto for a lot of things these days, including as, you know, when the marketers get a hold of your title, when you're publishing a book, they try to kind of mess with it. And so back in last November, they tried to change my title, and I wrote them a long, passionate letter that ended, Leave It As It Is. And I was thinking, Leave It As It Is also applies to the pandemic. We might have left bats as they are. That would have been smart. And it's just this human tendency. And I think I quote my professor, Reg Sauner, in the first couple pages. We humans are an elsewhere. It's so hard for us not to be always rushing ahead, wanting to do the next thing, wanting to dig up the next thing. And Roosevelt, of course, was that sort of character. But he also understood that in the case of the natural world, at times, it is hugely important, even if it doesn't make sense to people, to leave it as it is.
A lot of what you said brings me to questions that I was going to ask later on. But before I forget, it wasn't really an epitaph, but your dedication you know, to Edmund Morris, who you give a little bit of edge to him over McCullough. They both won the National Book Award, but Bate won the Pulitzer Prize. So I'll give that to you. But I love David McCullough though.
Yeah, I'm sorry, David, that you came in third in this competition, but it was a very steep, and you know, this is the Olympics basically, and you were on the podium.
What about Walter Jackson Bate though? Where did that come from?
Yeah. I'd like to talk. I mean, for me, he gets the gold even beyond Morris. So I'll just talk about them both for a second. You said at the beginning that people now don't really know about Roosevelt, and there was actually a long period, you know, in the 20th century, where if he was known, it was just as that caricature, you know, like bully, you know, the whole thing. And in fact, I've been doing a series of talks with a Teddy Roosevelt impersonator, and it's kind of funny to see people all perk up when he comes charging on. But really, the rehabilitation and the reinvigoration of his, you know, reputation came thanks to those two books, which actually came out around the time I went to college. I think it was the late 79, 80, and they came out pretty much within a year of each other. And the Morris one in particular, for me, is this great act of empathy, but it's like Roosevelt himself in his own writings. It's this thrilling pep talk. You cannot read that book unless you're dead-minded without it being contagious, like particularly if you read about him building his body or moving out to the Badlands, you suddenly find yourself wanting to do more work each day and wanting to, you know, rush into things and have adventures. And that gets to my point about biography, which will bring me to Walter Jackson Bate, which is I had classes with Walter Jackson Bate, great biographer. Both of his main biographies won the Pulitzer Prize. One also won the National Book Critics Circle Award. But he wrote biographies of John Keats and Samuel Johnson. And I had him when I was a freshman in college. And it changed my life, basically. And his contention was, kind of paraphrasing Samuel Johnson, that biography is a thrilling art because we can take from it, that we can put to use what we read. We can read about Roosevelt's life, and of course we're not going to admire or take the negative parts, but we can say, this is how you do it. So this idea for me, you know, particularly in the age of the cancel culture and going back and kind of judging these past figures like amateur St. Peter's, do they go to heaven or hell? That's not even where I am. I'm over here saying I go to these figures for that same old reason of what I can take from them. And I write biography hoping to create the same feeling in my readers. I mean, I'm not a biographer to the degree those two are. I'm more of a biographical adventurer. But I'm still trying to give you a sense of this person for you. You know, you want to read it and think about your own life and how you can, and that's why biography is so thrilling to me.
And that's interesting you say it that way, because you want to read and think of your own life. And, you know, it's funny, you're hyper-caffeinated, as is Roosevelt, and you are in the book too.
I'm not quite as, you should see us during our book talks where he comes in. It's a competitive talking situation, but I would give the nod to Teddy over me as far as word volume and word.
No, I'm talking about the coffee. that goes to what I was going to say. Is, you know, when you talk about you drinking coffee, talk about him being hyper about drinking coffee. The book is just as much about you as it is about Roosevelt, which is what intrigued me the most, because you interweave the two. Not that you're comparing yourself to his, you know, right, greatness, but you it's you, and then that's why it's good that Noah's in it, because, you know, you're obsessed with this, and then Noah's like, every once in a while, he's like, all right, I'm kind of sick of this.
Yeah. Well, it was, you know, to give people who are listening kind of a sense of it, there are several threads to the book, and Roosevelt's biography is one, Saving Bear's Ears National Monument is another. Right. But the spine kind of is this road trip I take with my nephew. I'm a professor in North Carolina. My nephew had just graduated from the University of North Carolina, Asheville. So in his, you know, he's just 21, just getting out of school. So I brought him along with me on this road trip up the East Coast to Roosevelt's home on Sagamore Hill to Harvard, and then out to the Badlands. And as you say, he kind of serves as a foil. And the funny thing is, I ask him early on, have you read anything lately? And he says, yeah, The Tao of the Dude, the Big Lebowski. And he's just, and he's kind of like that. He's laconic. He wouldn't have said one word on the way to the Pacific if I hadn't, you know, given him. So he starts, you know, I'm always playing these Roosevelt biographies, these Roosevelt speeches on the car stereo. And he's just rolling his eyes by the end. And as I say in the book, if he heard the phrase manly vigor one more time, he was going to strangle me. So he does work as a foil for sure.
And so what about, given that, I don't know how many times you listen to The Man in the Arena when you're driving, but but the thing about it is, you take that speech, and it's funny because I was watching Charlie Rose one time, and you know the poem Invictus, and he read it out loud, and Charlie Rose said it was the most magical moment in the show, and that's how a lot of people think about The Man in the Arena.
Yes.
And like Nelson Mandela, like you talk about Nelson Mandela giving it to the rugby team before they played. Yes. Do you think you've lived your life that way? I don't. I regret it, but regret's not a really positive emotion. Do you feel like you've tried to do that?
That's a great question, and one I haven't tackled in other interviews. I would say the area where I would be self-critical regarding The Man in the Arena is from the same place that made me write this book, which is, I feel like in many of the areas, in terms of writing passionately and playing Ultimate Frisbee and living the way I chose, you know, Thoreau was really more of a model, right? And he said, the life that men praise and call successful is but one kind. And I feel I've followed my dream. You know, I didn't publish a book till I was 35, and now I've published 11, and it was a long haul to get here. Where I feel I did not live up to that idea was in the political activist end. And maybe it's simply, that's not my bent. You know, I'm more of a Thoreauvian than a Rooseveltian in the end. But the speech itself, The Man in the Arena, seems at once outdated right now and amazingly relevant. Outdated in that it talks about, you know, these virtues of, you know, manly, da-da-da. But relevant in that when we think of the cancel culture and the critics that come at you, and I don't even want to use the phrase cancel culture because it has political overtones, but of people criticizing you, the ability to do despite the criticism is really what it's about. It's about, I'm gonna throw myself out there, and if you want to take me down, you spend your energy doing that. I'm gonna spend my energy trying to do what I passionately care about. So in one regard, I do feel like I've led a life that way, but in the more political activist end, I haven't. And sometimes I think that's a little cowardly of me. And one nice thing of Roosevelt is it's like, you know, drinking a medicine, an anti-cowardice medicine to read him. You know, whatever his flaws, and there are many, you can't say he wasn't brave. And that's, you know, and Samuel Johnson said, courage is the virtue without which other virtues are impossible. You know, you need to have that level of courage to kind of then act out what you care about.
Well, when you were just saying about political activism, you mentioned in the book, because you say that as an advocate, the word fills you with unease.
Sure.
But at the same time, it seems like you are an advocate. You actually are, but then you say it fills you with unease. So I wonder what that ambivalence actually is.
Well, I guess, you know, my early ambition, like I hated when I was called a nature writer early in my career. I didn't think of myself as an environmentalist. As an environmentalist, I thought of myself as a writer. And as a writer, I believe, you know, one of my favorite poets is A.R. Ammons. And he wrote, no humbling of reality to precept, and firm ground is not available ground. I've always felt comfortable in what, you know, the area Keats called it negative capability, and the kind of uncertain, contradictory, you say one thing and you go opposite of it. And that's like kind of the artist's realm, quite different than the politician's realm, where you have to say, like, Roosevelt was great. I mean, he was a writer too. He wrote 47 books, but he was great at, you know, we remember from Clinton, it's the economy, stupid. Roosevelt could hammer like, you know, a point over and over, day after day. And that's partly the politician's gift. And that's a gift I don't have.
The thing about it is, now that you said about the 46 books, is like, whenever I've read about him, but especially in your book, it's like, how did he have the time to do what he did between all of his writing, his home life, which was tragic, and campaigning, and then taking off for 3 or 4 days with John Muir? It seems like it's like six different people. How did he have the time? I mean, everyone has the same 24 hours, and I understand. He just never stopped, right?
Yeah, it was the coffee. But, you know, also he read a book a night at one point in his life. And so he'd get to the end of a day, you know, he's had maybe dinner with dignitaries or whatever. And he said, one of my favorite quotes of his is, "Reading for me is like a disease." He was a compulsive reader as well as a writer. So, you know, there's a great story, one of my favorite, and it's probably told best again by Edmund Morris, where he's just moved out to the Badlands with his ranch hands, who are from Maine, and he's built his ranch on the Little Missouri, and boat thieves come by and steal the scow and start taking off. Well, it's the only boat around, so the ranch hands have to rebuild a new boat, or build a new boat to chase after it. It's the middle of winter. The river is chock full of ice. It's hazardous to, you know, navigate. And as Roosevelt's leaving the house, he grabs Anna Karenina. And so he's chasing down boat thieves, taking breaks to read Tolstoy, captures the boat thieves. They can't fit them all in the boat, and they can't navigate it right. So he walks them until his feet are ripped apart with blisters to the town of Dickinson. Then the other part of him is he's a relentless self-promoter. That's kind of more of his Trumpian side, right? So he takes a picture later with the pretending that the ranch hands are the, and he's pointing a gun at them. So he self-promotes this thing he's done, which is truly heroic when he did it. But he's got this other level. I always think, like, you ask how he does these things, I think of him as a kind of reality show onto himself, where he's having all these adventures, doing all these things, but then he's self-conscious enough to be writing them up.
Yeah, well, that's why I've always thought, you know, okay, that boat story and the Four Eyes story in the bar, I'm thinking maybe they're apocryphal, but they're definitely not, right?
No, he did do these things, you know, and as I say, I felt a little twinge as I said he was self-conscious, because he was also remarkably unself-conscious at times, in terms of, you know, he would act in a way we would like politicians to act now, not looking at the polls, not, you know, kind of going from the gut. And his gut, increasingly, at least in the political arena, was magnanimous and liberal as he continued in his career, even though, as I say in the book, on some levels, we have to regard him as a racist, and not just of his time, but before his time in a way. Like, if we give him credit for being prescient and ahead of his time as an environmentalist, we have to call him on Manifest Destiny, which you've got to remember was 50 years old. You know, it was an old concept, and he was revitalizing in a way his American empire. So he wanted to make America great again, and that's part of it too, you know?
Yeah, I mean, he was a man of his time. That's not really an excuse, but it kind of is. And, you know, I was reading about this whipping post they had in Delaware. They used it until, like, 1973, and most of the people they whipped were black. And they took it down and put it in a warehouse. And I'm thinking, they should leave it up. We need to remember what we did, whether it's the idea of taking down a statue of Woodrow Wilson, you know, or Francis Scott Key.
Sure.
it doesn't make any sense because this is what we were. And that's what you do in your book. Yeah. He's a package of different things. And that is what he was. It doesn't mean we should forget him or as you said, cancel him.
And let me look, you know, I was thinking about this, about a new project I'm working on. They're really, we should never turn our back on the past. But I think when we talk about uses of the past, there are two, like, for me, main uses. One is the one I mentioned earlier, the Walter Jackson Bate concept of, you know, what can we take from it? What do we admire? What can we grow? And in that regard, until a few years ago, it was just common sense to assume people were of their time. We didn't expect people to be talking about Newton, you know, talking about gravity before Newton. You know, we just didn't expect, you know, we just commonsensically said, and we had a simple test. What would that person be like now? And what would someone from now be like then? So I have some very woke colleagues at the university who talk a good show. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, how bad they would have been if they were, you know, I could see them as slave owners sort of thing. Right. So the other use to me is to honestly face the darkness and the difficulty of the legacy. I live in a town, Wilmington, North Carolina, where in 1898 there was what is considered the only coup in the United States, where it was a majority black city, violent overthrow, at least 60 people dead, almost all black, and totally changed the town to this day. And I think by honestly facing that, that's another use of the past. And I tried to do both things in the book. So when it came to Roosevelt's attitude toward Native Americans, which are, you know, somewhat unforgivable, I didn't forgive him. I just laid them out, what he said. And I think I say in the book that, you know, biographers often take something bad someone did, and then they make a quick excuse. Like they say, well, he wasn't good with African Americans, but he invited Booker T. Washington to the White House. So that's okay, you know. Or they move briskly along. And I just kind of lay it out there and try to say, this is part of a complex, hypocritical, messy human being from that time, who we can still take things from and put to use in our own way.
Yeah, it's like some of the Rough Riders being Native Americans. You know, one thing we should do is, I guess we need it, I probably should have done it earlier. We need to go back to the beginning when he was this sickly asthmatic kid and then he pulled himself up by his own bootstraps because he felt that he had to, and his admiration for his father.
Sure.
One of the stories that's really seminal is this idea of, and I'm gonna say it, but you're gonna have to explain it, when he's 7 years old and he sees the dead seal. I don't know how anyone can understand it unless you explain it.
Sure. Well, I'll take your first part first, which is the dad was this huge figure. Sometimes people ask me, you know, why, since he has these similarities with Trump, growing up silver spoon in mouth in New York City, why did he turn out so different? You know, why did he grow? Why was he a grower and eventually learned empathy? And I think the dad has a lot to do with it. You know, that they called him Great Heart. He was a big philanthropic figure. He was one of the founders of the American Museum of Natural History. And he encouraged Roosevelt to read, which Roosevelt did avidly, no pun intended here. And also, he's the one who went to him and said, you know, Roosevelt was a sickly, asthmatic youth. And he said, you must make your body. And Roosevelt responded by this, you know, I call it in the book, like it's like a raw upper class, upper crust Rocky montage. He started lifting weights and calisthenics, and he literally built his body up when he went from being this scrawny youth into this burly guy. But another thing was going on at the same time, and you mentioned the seal. Roosevelt was fascinated at first by stories of adventure, and then he became really fascinated by adventurous naturalists like Charles Darwin. And he suddenly got the idea of himself being a naturalist, and that solidified when he saw this seal that had been hauled up to the fish docks in New York. And he was really excited about this creature from the depths that he could study. He came back the next day, measured it, you know, took notes on it. And then what starts to happen is he starts to write and think about birds. And as I say in the book, birds are kind of his transport out of his little isolated world into the larger world. He was wealthy, so his family went down the Nile one year, and he took all these notes and he started to write. And two things had happened that year. It was his 14th year. He'd recently gotten a pair of glasses, so suddenly the world, which had been blurry, came into focus, and he'd gotten a gun. And ornithologists, birders of that day, used to shoot their birds, and he shot them and studied them. But his first real writing comes from birds, and I think birds were his way into sentences, you know, and so these two different things are happening at once, you know, kind of this building of this rocky macho man and this love of the natural world and seeing outside of the human world. And his dad was a proponent of muscular Christianity, which at the time, this idea that Christ wasn't some meek, skinny character, but he was a manly Christ, right? And I like to think that through the combination of all these, this kind of confluence of these parts of his personality, he started to embody a muscular environmentalism. That's what he brought to us, is this idea of like a vibrant champion, you know, fighting for the environment. But a lot of threads, right? I mean, he's got, yeah, like you said, he's got multiple personalities all kind of coming together.
That's why I'm sitting here writing down all these questions, and I will never be able to get to all of them. But then that reminds me of the fact that you love birds too, and then the fact that the best part of the birds that he liked was the aural part. So that, yeah, they're all going around in my head. But yeah, then you talk about the Nile, and is it pronounced plovers or plovers?
Well, you know, people pronounce it both ways. I've always gone with plover. But if you look, you know, if you look it up, right, I think plover may be the majority. Certainly in England, they call them plovers, I'm sure. In fact, I was just I'm on the road right now in Cape Cod. I just saw a semi-palmated plover. So pretty cool.
Well, the one you talk about that's the most beautiful concept is the waterfall. And out of the waterfall, it comes. And you're like ecstatic about it. So in a lot of ways, there are similarities, because I felt like he would have felt the same way that you felt. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm a little taller and probably more handsome than Theodore was, but other than that.
Yeah, I don't know whose glasses I like better. I always
Well, you know, we have a president who says he's the same as, he's better than, or at least the same as Roosevelt in terms of environmentalism. So there you go. I'm not the only one comparing myself to TR these days.
Right. And the Bible is his second favorite book after the book that he didn't write in the first place. Yeah.
Let's not go down that hole.
Well, I may go down on the one quote. Wait a minute. I'm going to do this. I shouldn't do it, but I will do it. Okay. I'm going to read the whole thing. Success is abhorrent if attained by the scarcity of fundamental principles of morality. The successful man, whether in business or politics, who has risen by consciousness, swindling of his neighbors by deceit and chicanery, by unscrupulous boldness and unscrupulous cunning, stands before society as a dangerous wild beast. I actually think Trump's kind of worse, because he doesn't use in that quote words like idiotic, ignorant, slovenly, cheat, bankrupt. Okay, that's as far as I'll go with my ranting, unless you want to add to it.
I'll add to it a little bit, and then I'll like kind of counterbalance it a tiny bit. And,
right,
and adding to it, you know, the real reason I started the book, it was the first year of Trump's presidency, and a lot of writer friends were writing immediate responses to whatever Trump had done the day before.
Right.
Not to call them knee-jerk responses, but they were quick. And this book, in a way, is a response, you know, a long thought out research response to one thing Trump was doing among his many, you know, his litany of terror. And that was his taking away of public land and in particular Bears Ears National Monument and Grand Staircase Escalante. So the book in a way grew out of Trump. And as you know, the moment where I just knew I had to write the book was I'd been involved in an anthology that was distributed to Congress in 2016, that was an anthology about Bears Ears, in the hope to established to create momentum to get Obama to proclaim Bears Ears, which he did in December of 2016. But the moment when I knew I had to write the book was 10 months later. I think it was on Roosevelt's 159th birthday, October 27th, 2018. And then Secretary of Interior Ryan Zinke declared, standing in front of a portrait of Roosevelt and claiming he was a Roosevelt Republican, that he was going to undeclare 85% of Bears Ears. So I was like, okay, all these things are coming together. Roosevelt, the Antiquities Act, and I've got to write this book. But the counterbalance part to your question is I talk in the book about Roosevelt felt like his path in politics was walking a ridge. And on one side of the ridge was what you were talking about, the unscrupulous, you know, the just money for money's sake, success for success sake. On the other side of the ridge were the dogmatic, you know, do-gooder with no budging at all, like kind of, you know, and we are seeing that so much right now, right? And he walked that ridge. He was trying to do good, but he knew that this perfect ideal of good was unattainable. So he kind of worked through this ridgeline. And so to me, that's a very helpful thing in terms of thinking about where we are now.
Yeah, I know, because I was thinking how at one point some of the, because he infuriated members of Congress by creating hundreds of millions of acres of land that thankfully for the most part is still with us. But he infuriated them and they thought he acted like a king.
Right.
With executive orders.
Yes. Yeah, they're borders for sure. You know, they were both perceived as their critics, as by their critics as bullies and, you know, imperialist. And he was, if you were on his side, again, maybe this is a similarity, you were pretty fired up when he took the Antiquities Act and was suddenly saving 800,000 acres of the Grand Canyon with it, which was, you know, unprecedented at the time. It's now very much precedented. It's how we, you know, he's the one who took the Antiquities Act in 1906 when it was created by Congress and just wielded it to unilaterally save, you know, all these national monuments. And his total was, was it 230 million acres in the end he saved? It, unbelievable.
So, again, this is all raising all kinds of stuff in my mind. It's hard to keep it straight. But as long as you're talking about Zinke, talk about Wood and the fishing trip, because that really kind of capsulizes it, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, Zinke was trying to pose as an outdoorsman. And I don't remember Wood's first name, writer for Outside Magazine. Yeah. But he did a great, great piece, which I quote in there, where Zinke's trying to kind of play the outdoorsman, and he has the rig on the wrong way, which I guess I'm not a fisherman, but any Montana fisherman or any fly fisherman would recognize right away. And that's actually leads me to an interesting point, is how people have used kind of the outdoorsman, athletic, vigorous politician image. What you see, and other biographers have written about this, is how many presidents that follow try to imitate the vigor that Roosevelt portrayed, like playing with his kids, roughhousing on the White House lawn, taking his cabinet, the tennis cabinet, because they played tennis together, romping through the woods, swimming naked in the middle of winter in these, you know, in Rock Creek Park, crazy stuff. But you later see, certainly FDR grew up, you know, hero worshiping TR and tried to recreate it despite his physical infirmities. And the TR's fair square deal, you know, is predecessor to the New Deal. But then you see the Kennedys throwing the football on the lawn. They're trying to create. And then Nixon quotes TR as he's leaving office, walking
across. That was so weird. August 9th, 1974. And he's telling his White House staff, the light of my life, but it had nothing to do with anything.
Yeah. Well, he's probably losing his mind at the moment. But then of all the people, it's, well, here's Ronald Reagan. And when Reagan comes to town, you know, he's all but wearing the Rooseveltian hat and claiming to be a rough rider. And so people have used this image. And actually, I speculate in the book of a future politician who wants to save land, who's Western, who does play the macho role a little bit, would be the perfect person to do just that, because it's an issue, conservation, where there's such an overlap between the liberal and the conservative. It's one of the few issues where historically, and still now to some degree, people have areas of agreement. Though, of course, as with everything else now, you know, we've turned it into this battle war. But, I mean, famously in the country after the Civil War, putting land aside and saving parkland was an issue both sides embraced and was seen as a time of healing for the country, the putting aside of public land. So it's too bad that we've turned even that into a battle, because so often we overlap in that area. I wrote a book called The Tarball Chronicles about the Gulf oil spill. And my hero in that book was this big hunting guide named Ryan Lambert. And Ryan and I became kind of friends, but he would tease me and call Obama my president. And, you know, we were politically so different, but we shared the land in common and the water and the fear of it being despoiled and ruined by BP. So I do think there's a potential of overlap there, as there is in almost no other issue.
It's funny. What's the name of that book Real and Sham History? That kind of touches on that, right?
Yep.
Yeah. The other thing is, when you talk about him, your friend saying, you know, you're President Obama, it's like when Muir and Teddy go off in the blizzard, and Muir says, when are you going to stop this boyish idea of killing things?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's funny how they kind of got on each other's nerves at point. I read about how he would put little flowers in Teddy's buttonholes and like a damn hippie, you know. And Roosevelt didn't like the fact that John Muir didn't know his birds.
Right. He was surprised.
But they mostly communed. I mean, I'm sure most people know the story, but basically on that same trip where he said, leave it as it is, a couple weeks later, he's in California and Roosevelt is supposed to go to this big fundraiser function. And instead he gets these guides and tells them to skirt civilization. And he and John Muir go off on a camping trip. And the first night's relatively mellow, and the second they trundle through a blizzard and they get up and have a fire. And I, in the book, I have these sections that are kind of fictional third person sections. So in that section, I come wandering into the fire and sit around with them, because I'd always wanted to. And you know, a lot of things at that fire, like out of that fire and the talk around it, grew saving much of the land north of Yosemite, and I think it really pushed Roosevelt's ideas even further in terms of conservation.
Kind of scared me, because they actually lit a tree on fire, and they thought of fires in California now. It's what about the 40 blanket thing? I don't get that. Really,
I don't either. I guess if you were his guide laid out, you know, I guess he thought, hey, the president is with us, so he laid out you know, probably 20 blankets below and 20 blankets above, and let Roosevelt sleep in those. And of course, they woke up underneath 5 inches of snow the next morning, which is pretty crazy when you think about the President of the United States out there without his Secret Service, you know.
Also, that they had to dig him out of the snow. He was buried, essentially. Yes, it's amazing. What? Tell us a little bit about, because I had no idea, probably most people wouldn't have any idea, but two of the people that you mentioned is Carsten Heyer and Harvey Locke. So talk a little bit about each of those people.
Well, starting with Harvey, one of the things that I say in the book is that there are problems with Roosevelt's vision. And part of those problems are the, you know, the non-inclusion of Native people, and the fact that parklands and national monuments were sometimes taken, you know, from Native lands and sacred lands, but that it was a pretty damn good first draft, and that it's up to us now to revise it and make it more inclusive, change it, and make it relevant for now, in a way that excites us just the way his vision excited then. And one of the aspects where I would keep Roosevelt's, you know, vision is in the sheer boldness of it. There was no reason there had to be all these parks. I mean, it was unprecedented, right? And what I looked for in the book were examples of people who were being equally bold now. And Harvey Locke, who was the kind of the storyteller, the conceiver of Yellowstone to Yukon, which is Y2Y, was just that kind of thinker. The idea was parks, when isolated, are like islands. And as, you know, as biologists say, islands are where species go to die because they're not connected. They can't. So the idea that he had was to create like rivers of parks, connective highways, so that animals could still migrate and move, particularly big carnivores could move up and down. And he did just that. He has done just that. The two of them have done just that, where starting in Yellowstone, they've created these wilderness corridors. Sometimes they'll go below a highway or above a highway. It's all it's so beautiful. It's all vegetated and trees are on it, and animals get used to it and can go right over. And so an animal can migrate from Yellowstone Park, you know, 1,000 miles away up to, you know, the edge of Alaska. And so this is an idea that has the boldness, you know, the same boldness that was there at the beginning of the idea of parks.
I remember when I was building in Florida, and we were building on a piece of property, and there was a bog turtle that we had to save. The bog turtles lived in holes with rattlesnakes. The rattlesnakes would protect the bog turtle, and the bog turtle would dig the hole for the rattlesnake to hang out in. And we had to build a tube under the road so they could go from side to side. Mm-hmm. And it was worth it. I mean, at first, first it was like, oh, this is going to cost a lot of money. But then I realized, you know, it's only basically, it's just giving them a square deal, you know?
Yeah.
Otherwise, they are on an island.
And that's a central thing in the book, which is I call Roosevelt out on various prejudices, and but what I say is he doesn't share the prejudice that so many of us have, which is anthropocentrism, the inability to see beyond the human, that other animals have concerns and cares that should be equally important to ours. And that's part of how we go about destroying the world with these blinders on that let us not see beyond human concerns. And it's really remarkable to have a president of the United States who's able to see beyond the human.
Yeah, I was talking to a friend of mine this morning, Joe, because I was telling him I was going to interview you, and we started talking about the species we're destroying. And we focused in just on honeybees alone and what their destruction would do. And then I think about how you were talking a little bit about the Green New Deal and AOC and all that. Well, you weren't talking about her, but I mean, honestly, I love the way you said, well, you actually kind of said we only have like 12 years left. It's like the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists having that clock with one minute left. And I'm thinking, do you really believe that we can rescue ourselves? Do you really believe that we can do it?
This isn't the kind of thing you're supposed to say on shows like this, but I must admit to feeling more pessimistic lately. You know, I'm right now I'm traveling with my daughter who's 17 and her friend, and we were in a cabin in Virginia when we got the news about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and listening to them talk, and to really for the first time, not the first time, but the last few years, start to think they really are getting such a raw deal
for kids.
And they are not going to have not just the physical environment, but the mental environment to imagine beyond, you know, the more hopeful environment that certainly I had growing up. I remember I was classmates with Bill McKibben, and I remember when End of Nature came out, and I didn't, you know, I liked the book a lot, but I kind of rebelled against it. I was like, there's no way this intrudes on me when I'm deep in the woods and having a nature moment, right? And it's taken a while to figure out that the tendrils of climate change and industrial expansion are everywhere. And it's really friggin' depressing. And, you know, and I think, you know, I'm writing a new book, which actually I'm writing super fast. It's due October 15th, and it's about Thoreau and the pandemic. And because I wrote a piece for American Scholar early on, and the lessons we can, you know, kind of take from the pandemic, which, you know, learning close to home, not traveling as much, letting things rewild, because we've seen so many examples of that. And there's some encouraging things there. And in a way, the lessons we're taking from the pandemic are kind of a rough draft of the lessons we need for climate change. But while I see little sparks of, you know, sprouts of green and hope, you know, the enemy is human nature. And it's my human nature too. It's all of ours. It's like the wanting of more, the hunger, the, you know, the insatiable aspect. And, you know, when I posted a thing on Teddy Roosevelt with Leave It As It Is, and a friend on Facebook posted a picture of him in a bulldozer digging the Panama Canal. And I said, well, you know, he's got other sayings too, like dig a big hole. I mean, so we're all these contradictory creatures. And are we going to be able to really galvanize around the idea of climate? And I will say this, you know, I'm frankly getting a little sick of Teddy Roosevelt after having sung his praises for a month. But man, mister, could we use a man like that right now? Imagine him as president. He'd be able, he's a scientist, he's a naturalist, he respects scientists. He's able, and this was able to do throughout his career, he's able to take these kind of arcane, difficult concepts and put them in vivid, simple prose and then speak them to people and inspire them. And when I think of the fact that with environmentalism, he not only fought for it, he created the arena it was fought in. I think if anybody could articulate why climate change is essentially World War III and has to be fought that way, it would be him, you know, or someone like him who could really put it vividly and just say, shake us by the lapels and say, you idiots, it's here. Because we all know, you know, anybody with any awareness knows it's not something in the future. I'm living in a hurricane bullseye, talking to my friends in California where the sky is orange, you know, so it's here. And we don't seem to accept that.
And instead, we have a president who says that California failed to sweep the floors of the forest and like they do in Norway, and the Norwegians say, we don't actually do that. Right. And I'm even more of a fatalist than you. It reminds me of the story about the reason why we don't see extraterrestrial life is because at the same time that a species begins to be able to go into interstellar space, they generally destroy themselves.
Yeah.
And that's where it seems like now we're getting to that point where we could almost do it, but I don't know. It's,
well, here's a hopeful thing I will say, and it's not hopeful about our future, but it's something I've always written about in a book called My Green Manifesto about the Charles River and other places. We went for a 4-mile hike before we did this morning. We're back on Cape Cod, which is kind of my first vibrant nature. And we, you know, it's an incredibly windy day. You can't take a boat out. We're cutting through the salt marshes. And the natural world still has that ability to kind of ring something, you know, to strike a chord inside me and the people I was with, right? And that's not hopeful in terms of the big picture. But it is interesting that you can still have that love. And without that love, you're not going to fight for anything, right? And that can be there. Now, that doesn't make me hopeful on the grand scale, but it does personally help a little bit.
Yeah, I remember flying from like New York to Los Angeles with my dad, and he would point down and he would go, look at all that. look at how much of it is just that.
Exactly.
And that's how you felt. And this is, I guess, totally off topic, but it was interesting when you don't say it explicitly, but you compare Teddy Roosevelt to someone who comes in the next generation, Ernest Hemingway.
Oh, yeah.
That was good. I mean,
yeah.
You don't say it, but it was really good because then I started thinking, oh, yeah, he shares some of the characteristics.
Well, Roosevelt was a trendsetter. And one of the trends was physical fitness. You know, that was, you know, maybe we owe jog bras to Teddy Roosevelt indirectly. Who knows? That's one of the ways things he inspired. The other, birding became bigger. And certainly kind of this macho game hunter image that Hemingway then became famous for, that kind of started. I mean, Roosevelt really, he goes on this huge safari the year after he's president and sends back, you know, all sorts of stuffed animals, which we will, you know, shake our fists at now. But, and even people did then, even people recognized his bloodthirstiness then, but it also contributed massively to the American Museum of Natural History. So again, he's a mess. He's kind of a
but Charles Darwin, the same thing. Thousands of birds euthanized, if you will. Yeah. But yeah, it's just there's lots of people who have this admixture of attributes. And what you do in the book, and we can conclude with this, I guess. What you do in the book is, oh, I know what you do, and you say it. You wanted to deconstruct him.
I mean, I want to recognize that the man in the arena, the point of the man in the arena is still valid. This was very much a person in the arena who gained us quite a few things, not just millions of acres, but I say that the Bull Moose Party platform is one that would have made Bernie blush. When he came back, he was so progressive, and his platform was so progressive in terms of suffrage, you know, women's suffrage years before it passes, in terms of essentially workers' comp, in terms of unemployment, in all these ways that would later be, you know, come to fruition under his distant cousin, FDR, he kind of led the way. And one of my favorite biographies is The Strenuous Life by Kathleen Dalton. And she suggests that the real story of Teddy Roosevelt isn't him building his muscles or going west, but his increased movement leftward and his openness to these liberal ideas and his empathy. Now, at the same time, many people have told the story of his later years as being ones of kind of twisted racism and warmongering for World War One. So there are thousands of Roosevelts and dozens of Roosevelt biographies and stories. But for me, I'm going there, as I said at the beginning, looking for what I can use. And the commitment, the passion, the fight for the natural world is central to that. And I think he still does a pretty good job of that. We need to take that rough draft and revise it and make it our own.
That's an excellent way to conclude the whole thing. So thanks, David, very much. David's the author of Leave It As It, in addition to lots of other great books, Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's American Wilderness. Thanks so much, David, for being with us today. I enjoyed our talk.
Thanks. Next time, we'll talk a little Ultimate Frisbee.
And that's what I wanted to do. Okay,
I'll see you. Bring me back for Ultimate Glory or for the Thoreau book. Whichever.
Anytime you want to come back and play Frisbee, I'm all for it. Okay. I'll bring my brother along.
Yeah, and I'll yell bully.
Okay, sounds great.